congressional hearing that was supposed to be a routine recap of global warming science got a bit heated. Republicans on the committee raised the issue of emails that were stolen from prominent climate scientists. The Republicans said the emails cast doubt on all climate science. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
The emails were stolen from the University of East Anglia in Britain from one of the three labs in the world that constructs global temperature records. The private exchanges have become a goldmine for skeptics who argue that global warming is a plot rather than a real man-made problem. At today's hearing, Republican Representative James Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin said, at best, official reports about global warming will now have to be reviewed.
And at worst, it's junk science, and it is a part of a massive international scientific fraud.
And not just fraud, he said.
There's increasing evidence of scientific fascism that's going on, and I think as policymakers who are making decisions about the state of the American economy for the next several generations, that we ought to have accurate science. And
the president's top science advisor, John Holdren, agreed that the emails should be thoroughly investigated. At issue is whether they provide evidence of scientific malfeasance or just bad manners.
Scientists are human. And from time to time, they display defensiveness and bias and even misbehavior of some kind. They're like any other group of human beings. They're subject to human frailties. I think the facts are not entirely in on this particular case.
Holdren agreed that if the emails reveal inappropriate data manipulation, and that ended up in official reports, obviously those reports would need to be corrected.
However this particular controversy comes out, the result will not call into question the bulk of our understanding of how the climate works or how humans are affecting it.
Evidence from many different sources shows that the air and oceans are warming as a result of greenhouse gases that humans are putting into the atmosphere. Jane Lubchenco, a scientist who heads the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, gave a tabletop demonstration at the hearing to show how increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is also making the oceans more acidic. Those explanations didn't reassure some Republican members of the committee, and Democrat Jay Inslee of Washington State was stunned by their skepticism. He said somewhat sarcastically, if global warming is a fraud, it must be perpetrated by a conspiracy of scientists from all around the world.
So I just want to ask you, if you're part of that massive international conspiracy, are either one of you members of the Trilateral Commission, Spectre, or Chaos? I just need an answer.
Congressman Inslee, I am not a member of any of those organizations, and I do not believe that there is a conspiracy. It would be an amazing thing indeed.
Holdren pointed out that national academies of science from all around the world accept the reality of human-induced global warming, as do other leading science organizations and the United Nations. Inslee then noted that nobody else in the room had any other plausible way to explain why carbon dioxide is building up in the air and in the oceans.
And yet people are trying to gin up this controversy because you know why? It's not because they're not intelligent. It's because they're afraid that we can't solve this problem.
He says we can. But the challenge here is that most of the public, including members of Congress, struggle to understand even the basic science. And now the leaked emails raise doubts about some of the climate scientists. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Scientists who do government-funded research should soon be able to get little vials of cells that were previously off-limits, stem cells. The National Institutes of Health has just okayed 13 stem cell lines made from human embryos. It's part of an effort to boost stem cell research, as NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports.
Back in August of 2001, President George W. Bush said scientists could use federal dollars to study human embryonic stem cells. But because of concerns about destroying embryos to extract the cells, only the small number of stem cell lines that had already been created were made eligible for public funds.
We have been restricted for the last 8 years, and only the most intrepid investigators have taken on the challenge of working with human embryonic stem cell lines.
George Daly is among the intrepid. His lab at Children's Hospital Boston has used private funds to create new stem cell lines. Earlier this year, when the Obama administration announced its intention to expand stem cell research, Daly jumped at the chance to get his cell lines approved for researchers using federal money.
We sent a 130-page document to the NIH back in July.
The paperwork showed that 11 of his cell lines met a slew of new ethical ethical requirements. The embryos used were left over from fertility treatments and donated by people who gave their informed consent. The NIH now has approved Daly's cell lines, along with two others from Rockefeller University in New York City. Francis Collins is director of the NIH. He says nearly 100 additional stem cell lines are under review.
I think people are champing at the bit for the opportunity to get started in exploring this area of research with federal funds.
And he says the NIH has already awarded about $21 million in grants for research on approved cell lines. More grants are expected early next year. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
The antique hunter's fantasy is to discover something extraordinary, sitting unnoticed in the corner of a shop. That fantasy came true for one young man 30 years ago. The man stumbled on a rosewood cabinet that contained a scientific treasure dating back a century and a half. This week, the cabinet went on display in a New York City museum. NPR's Christopher Joyce has the story.
Alfred Russel Wallace was a globe-trotting British naturalist who, in the mid-1800s, got the idea that living things evolve and diversify by passing on valuable traits to their offspring. Charles Darwin had the same idea and crafted his theory of evolution. Wallace got a pat on the back. According to David Grimaldi of the American Museum of Natural History, fortune and fame eluded Wallace.
He had to really support himself by collecting specimens and selling these to museums. And that supported him when he was in the field in Brazil and in Indonesia and Malaysia. But he kept some of the specimens aside for himself. Beautiful specimens.
Specimens he kept in a rosewood cabinet. Of his own design, the cabinet held 24 drawers full of iridescent butterflies, enormous moths, seashells, and hundreds of beetles. Wallace believed it was the lowliest of creatures that led him and Darwin to the idea of evolution.
They were both beetle hunters, and that gave them an appreciation for diversity and variation.
Fast forward to 1979. The cabinet sits in a modest antique shop in Arlington, Virginia. A young lawyer named Robert Hegestad wanders in looking for Chinese carpets.
And I saw this beetle cabinet behind the counter and asked if it was for sale.
The dealer said yes.
And I said, how much? And he said, $600. And he said, don't you want to see what's inside it? And I said, no, not really.
And the dealer said, you really should. This is no ordinary cabinet.
He described it as belonging to Alfred Russel Wallace. And I, of course, had never heard of Alfred Russel Wallace.
Nonetheless, he bought the cabinet, $100 a month for 6 months.
And then I kind of lost interest and over the years basically used it as a show-and-tell case, you know, at parties.
But eventually Hegestad read enough about Wallace to get drawn in. He realized the cabinet's value to the history of science, so this week it goes on display at the museum in New York.
And now I have a great big empty space in my dining room, and I have to go shopping, find something to replace it.
Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
If your ears cannot quite hear what someone is saying, you might want to try listening with your skin. New research shows that sensations on the skin can help you understand speech. NPR's John Hamilton has the story, so listen up.
It's been clear for a long time that hearing involves more than just our ears. Brian Jick is a professor of phonetics at the University of British Columbia.
From our brain's point of view, we can hear with our eyes.
Jick says that's why people in a noisy room are more likely to understand someone if they can see the speaker's lips. But Jick wanted to see whether hearing could also be influenced by our sense of touch. So he had a graduate student round up some volunteers. They listened to a person making speech sounds, pa, ba, ta, da. Meanwhile, the graduate student stood by with a turkey baster.
She would squirt a little puff of air from the turkey baster onto the neck of the perceiver. And people had very strong responses to it.
Specifically, people did a much better job recognizing certain consonants when they were accompanied by a puff of air. That's not as odd as you might think. The sounds in question were pa and ta. To make those sounds, the mouth sends out a little burst of air. In contrast, the sounds ba and da do not come with a burst. And the brain seems to know that. Jick confirmed this with a high-tech version of the turkey baster experiment. He used an automated device to deliver tiny, precisely timed puffs of air to a person's hand or neck while they listened to audio recordings with a lot of background noise.
Ta, ba, ta, da.
What we found was that the little puff of air would cause them to be more likely to report having heard a sound like pa, even if what had actually been played to them was ba.
Jake says what's really interesting about this is that people don't normally use their skin to understand speech, yet they did it automatically. Jake says that suggests our brains are wired to incorporate information from other senses when we listen.
From my point of view, we're whole body perceiving machines, and we just take all of the information that comes at us in our environment and merge it into a percept of something that happened in the world.
That's an idea that's becoming widely accepted among brain scientists. David Ostry is a professor of psychology at McGill University in Montreal. A few months ago, he did a different experiment that involved touch and hearing.
We put small plastic tabs on the side of the cheeks, and we had a robot basically pull on the facial skin.
People did a better job recognizing a sound if the robot tugged their facial skin in the same direction it would have moved if they'd been making the sound themselves. Ostry says these days, the big scientific question isn't whether our brains routinely integrate sensory information, but how.
Really, it's up for grabs where within the brain this kind of integration is happening.
Ostry says it could be happening in areas that process sensory information, or in the motor cortex, which controls our muscles. Research on how hearing is influenced by other senses could help people with hearing loss, or people like airline pilots who need to understand speech in noisy environments. The new study appears in the journal Nature. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Now let's go to a not-so-noisy environment, the redwood forests of California. There's an experiment going on there to turn trees into what are called carbon banks. The idea is to manage forests so they absorb more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and slow down global warming. At next month's big climate meeting in Copenhagen, one proposal is to pay countries to do this. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, California has already started.
For carbon banking, you need carbon accountants, people who can put hard numbers on how much carbon trees breathe in and out. Some of these accountants can be found in the Big River Forest, a mountainous swath of oak, Douglas fir, and redwood in Mendocino County. On a rain-slick road, tractors are unloaded from trailers for a day's logging. But the Conservation Fund, an environmental group, has bought 16,000 acres of this forest and put it aside for an experiment. This part of the forest is hardly pristine. A walk along a muddy trail with the fund's Chris Kelly takes us through thick undergrowth and small trees, the kind of forest that comes up after heavy logging.
This forest, if you look around, you see it's very dense. You almost, in some places, you couldn't walk through it. It's as if you just cast out seeds on the ground in your garden and then didn't come back and weed it. As a result, you get a choked garden with skinny carrots and underripe fruit.
But that's just the kind of forest the Conservation Fund is banking on, literally.
So what we're trying to do is come in and thin the forest and leave the bigger trees to grow. And as a consequence of that thinning, they will grow bigger faster.
In essence, what these foresters are doing is weeding out some trees so that the remaining forest will grow faster and absorb more carbon than it does now. This is where the accounting comes in. It's tricky. If you cut down a tree, its carbon goes up into the atmosphere. So foresters here have to prove their weeding will produce a net gain, more carbon stored in the trees that remain and grow than is released when the foresters weed. That means measuring, lots of measuring.
I'm Madison Thompson. I'm a forestry technician for the Conservation Fund. First things first, we're going to find how much downed wood there is within a 1/10 acre radius. That's one of the things that we measure.
Downed wood, meaning fallen trees, tree limbs, even big branches. When they eventually rot, they emit carbon. There are liabilities in the balance sheet.
Watch for the poison oak. Point it out when you see it.
Thompson and his colleague Liz Forwind are covered head to toe in rain gear. It's steep and overgrown with ferns and poison oak. They scramble down a ravine and crawl up the other side to measure a stand of young redwoods. The redwoods are the assets, like the bank vault, where the big carbon gets stashed away year by year. Jordan Gollenkopf is the fund's mathematician. He keeps the balance sheet.
Redwoods are kind of amazing because they can grow for hundreds and hundreds of years and still be, you know, measurably increasing in size and growing.
Most of the redwoods here are fairly young, so they have a lot of growing ahead of them.
25. 25 inches?
Yeah.
A typical 25-inch diameter redwood can store about a ton of carbon.
If I wrapped a tape around its tree and measured it, and I knew its height roughly, you know, I can get a volume. And then once you know the mass, carbon is roughly 50% of the mass of most trees.
The fund calculates that over 2 years, their forest has soaked up an extra 350,000 tons of carbon. That's roughly equivalent to taking 80,000 cars off the road for a year. And Golenkopf says there are other benefits.
By managing for carbon, we're not going to be harvesting as much, and harvest disturbs the soil. Harvest reduces the size of the trees. And so in general, when we have bigger trees and less disturbance, you have creeks like this are shaded, they stay cooler, fish like that. Creeks like this have less sediment running into them.
Okay, now you've banked your carbon, so what's it worth? Well, the fund is actually making money from Big River by selling carbon credits to people trying to green up their image or who want to offset their carbon footprint. Every ton of carbon is worth one credit. It's a small market now, mostly in California, but it's growing, and negotiators in Copenhagen want to do the same thing around the world. Gary Gero runs the Climate Action Reserve, which sets standards for carbon trading in California. He says once you legally limit carbon emissions, carbon banking starts to make business sense.
Businesses in California said, we know you're going to regulate this someday, so give us the ability to start now reducing greenhouse gas emissions and ensure that we are recognized for those reductions.
And that, adds Gero, gives people who own forests a new option.
Whether or not they're going to be driven towards the timber industry or whether they can actually make a living at being a carbon supplier.
With next month's Copenhagen conference looking less likely to produce a grand new climate plan, negotiators are now talking about some sort of forest carbon deal instead, if they can figure out how to do the accounting. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.